more benefit to the Mediterranean diet?
Does tobacco control actually reduce smoking-related deaths?
How can we best help people cease smoking cigarettes?
And a novel treatment for obstructive sleep apnea.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on January 10th, 2014, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
And Rick, I'm happy to report to our long-suffering listeners that we have finally remedied the broken link to iTunes. So those folks who subscribe via iTunes ought to be able to get their automatic updates starting this week.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth. I appreciate you taking care of that.
It sure took a long time, and I apologize. Hopefully everybody is going to listen to us anyway, even though our technical support is sometimes not quite what we'd like it to be. Why don't we move right into what I served up as the Mediterranean diet? One more great thing about that, and at the moment, I'd actually like to go to the Mediterranean and eat that diet, but failing that, in Annals of Internal Medicine, additional benefits for folks with diabetes.
Well, although eating this diet in the Mediterranean may be the most preferable option, you don't have to go there to actually enjoy the benefits of it. This is a diet that's rich in fat. About 35 to 40% of the energy comes from fat, but it's especially from vegetable sources such as olive oil and nuts. It also involves a moderate amount of consumption of alcohol, mainly wine, and frequent use of sauces that have tomatoes, onions, garlic, spices. We've talked about the benefits of it overall in terms of reducing cardiovascular risk, but there's been an interest in knowing whether it can actually prevent diabetes as well. Because most of the lifestyle changes we know that affect diabetes involve things like weight loss through energy-restricted diets or increasing physical activity. These things can reduce the risk of diabetes by as much as 50%. But there was a hint that the Mediterranean diet could also do the same thing. So this study is a subgroup analysis of a multi-center randomized trial in which people were randomized to one of three diets, either a regular diet, where they're just encouraged to have a low-fat diet, or a Mediterranean diet that was supplemented with extra virgin olive oil or supplemented with nuts. And what they found is when they followed individuals for over 4 years, the Mediterranean diet that was supplemented with the extra virgin olive oil decreased the incidence of diabetes by 40% in this older, high-risk population. And the diet that was supplemented with nuts decreased it by 18%, although it wasn't statistically significantly different.
And also, there was no reduction in weight in these groups, I believe.
This wasn't a caloric-restricted diet. This was just a change from what might normally be called a Western diet to a healthier diet, Mediterranean diet.
Right. So I guess my point is that this idea that somehow this increased body mass is the mechanism by which folks develop type 2 diabetes is somewhat called into question by this study.
Absolutely. Certainly physical activity and weight contribute to the risk of diabetes, but this indicates that a diet that really doesn't change weight and there was no change in physical activity can still affect the incidence of diabetes. And it's thought to be due to either anti-inflammatory or antioxidant properties in the diet, although that's just a hypothesis. We really haven't proven that yet. I'd like to eat this diet, particularly in the Mediterranean.
Me too, especially right now. Let's move then to the New England Journal of Medicine. Obstructive sleep apnea, once again, a problem that seems to be increasing secondary to weight gain and upper airway stimulation.
This is a novel therapy for a problem that's more rampant than people realize. It's estimated that approximately 13% of men and 6% of women in North America have clinically important obstructive sleep apnea. This is an anatomical compromise in which the soft tissues lead to increased airway collapsibility, particularly when the person's asleep. And we know that obstructive sleep apnea is associated with an increased risk now of diabetes and high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease. Many people can be treated with what's called continuative positive airway pressure, or CPAP, where people wear a mask. But for many individuals, this is either not acceptable, or in some individuals, it actually doesn't solve the issue. So this is a novel therapy called upper airway stimulation, where it was noted that if they could stimulate the nerve that innervates the tongue, it causes the tongue to move forward, it can actually improve the structural abnormalities that cause obstructive sleep apnea. So it took 126 participants that all had obstructive sleep apnea, and they had the type that they could document that the airway muscles were closing during sleep. And in these individuals, they put in this stimulator, and by the way, this is a generator that sits right underneath the clavicle. It has a lead that tunnels up under the skin and innervates the hypoglossal nerve right at the top of the neck, and another lead that actually senses the ventilation. So at night, when the ventilation started to decrease, it would stimulate the hypoglossal nerve to move the tongue. It decreased the apnea by about 75%. So this novel therapy resulted in significant and clinically meaningful reductions in the severity of obstructive sleep apnea.
While this is extremely impressive, to me, it also sounds pretty invasive in order to overcome this problem.
The procedure itself is not terribly invasive. Most people were out of the hospital within 24 hours, and it was tolerated very well by most individuals. The complication rate was just 2%. Again, for individuals that either don't respond to CPAP or can't tolerate it, this is a novel therapy that might be very effective.
I think it's provocative, it's interesting, but it sounds like a lot of technology. Maybe there's another way we can do this without actually having to implant the thing.
Well, it's certainly not for everybody. I think it's nice to have alternatives to therapy we know is effective when it can't be administered.
Okay. Let's turn from here then to the Journal of the American Medical Association. The entire issue this week is devoted to this issue of cigarette smoking, its multitudinous impact in deleterious health outcomes, how to quit, and so forth. We've selected two of those studies to talk about this week, one of them focusing on smoking cessation aids.
In this particular case, they looked at the different pharmacologic treatments for smoking cessation. They looked at three first-line smoking cessation treatments: nicotine replacement therapy, use of bupropion or Wellbutrin, or the use of varenicline, also called Chantrix. What they discovered by looking at over 267 studies from 12 different reviews and over 100,000 patients is that there were higher rates of smoking cessation with the pharmacologic treatments than there were with placebo. Over 6 months, those that received placebo, only about 10.6% stopped smoking. Those that received nicotine replacement therapy, about 17.6%, and those that received bupropion, 19.1%. The use of varenicline or combination nicotine replacement was even better. With varenicline, 27.6% stopped smoking, and with the combination nicotine replacement therapy, 31.5%. And by the way, none of these therapies was associated with an increased risk of serious adverse events.
Well, now that's really interesting, isn't it? Because we've certainly seen some warnings coming over the transom about varenicline.
Both varenicline and bupropion have box warnings from the FDA regarding potential risk of neuropsychiatric events.
Clearly, this study was limited to pharmacologic interventions. Was there any mention of cognitive behavioral therapy or other types of psychotherapy in conjunction with these smoking cessation aids?
This particular study did not, but they do make the statement that their findings are consistent with the recommendations of the U.S. guidelines, which recommend medications plus counseling.
Clearly, then, the other study focuses on, if you quit, what are the benefits?
I'm glad you picked this particular one, because this one marks the 50th anniversary of the first Surgeon General's report on smoking and health. And it was the first Surgeon General's report that inspired governments and non-governmental organizations and even the private sector to try to reduce the effects of cigarette smoking. And these programs have included things like education, increases in cigarette taxing, smoke-free air laws, media campaigns, marketing restrictions, lawsuits. And the real question is, how effective have these been in reducing smoking-related premature deaths? They were able to estimate from 1964 to 2012 that there were 17.7 million deaths related to smoking, but 8 million reduction, that is, there would have been 25.7 million had we not had these programs. And of the increase in lifespan, 7.8 years for men and 5.4 years for women, the cigarette smoking reduction is responsible for 2.3 years of that life expansion in men and 1.6 years in women.
Yeah. On the other hand, we still have smoking rates that are about 1 in 5 adults in the U.S. And we know, and I believe it says in this particular issue of JAMA, a statement I thought was really quite interesting, that cigarettes, of course, are noteworthy in their lethality. Once again, I have to get back to this same old issue that I say every single time. How do we allow something that's clearly as deleterious as cigarettes are to continue to be sold?
Elizabeth, your point's well taken. What this study highlights is the fact that if we decrease cigarette smoking by all the means we have available, there's a significant impact. Most of these deaths occur in individuals under the age of 65. In those individuals, it cuts their life by about 20 years. So we still have a lot of work to do. What this shows is the work that we're doing has made a significant impact.
Excellent. On that upward-looking note, I will say that I'm going to talk about the Mediterranean diet and diabetes this week, just because I really like this idea. It's cold here in Baltimore. I'd like to be at the Mediterranean on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.